we calculated 2 years ago, we were spending a half day a week of maintenance for the whole farm. I realized it just didn't work as an ecosystem. It didn't function very well. So,
hello and welcome to the Permaculture Vine podcast. Today we have delighted to welcome Stefan Sokoviak to the show. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you, Cormac. Great to be here.
It's great to have you on. Stefan, I know most people might know you on here, but could you just give us a quick 30-second introduction, please?
I'm a biologist by training, landscape architect. Then I learned about permaculture, got so interested in it, I realized I needed to have some land to practice. We bought a 4,000-tree apple orchard, worked it as a organic orchard for 15 years, tore it out and started over with a permaculture orchard. Have been doing it for the last 15 years. Excuse me.
So I just up for both of it ropey this morning.
Yeah, it's a little dry.
I have not been well either. I've been laid up for a week. But we'll soldier on through. That's great stuff. I've followed your stuff for a long time, especially the three trios. I always put them in my designs. So I have like a template now in Affinity. I just drop the stuff in. Depending then on the grow zone and climate, then adjust what's in them. So do you want to tell us about that? How you came to buy an orchard and then the process of changing that around to a permaculture orchard?
Yeah, we bought and converted it. Well, we tried it for a long time, leaving it monoculture and having just apples. But two things. One, a clientele. We work as a membership UPIC, and the people basically would say, what else do you have? And I knew the first year, I thought, oh boy, all we have is apples. I said, we have this other apple or this other apple. But it was, no, what else do you have? You know, we traveled. And so if somebody ever decides to do UPIC, realize you don't want to be a single product store. You want to be just like a grocery store. You want to have a whole range of products available. And that's what we didn't have. So we tried anyway and selling in different ways, our apples, and we do juice. But I realized it just didn't work as an ecosystem. It didn't function very well. So we ended up tearing it out and then starting over. Not a way I'd recommend, but that's what we did. I've done videos about the mistakes because I've done pretty well all of them. But you know what? Sometimes just keep going. That's the important thing. Start and keep going. And you never know where it will end up.
So why was it permaculture that particularly, why did you move towards that? Did you hear about it, or was that part of your research, or did you stumble upon it? Or
yeah, for me, I remember the very day I was in the library and this book, the designer's manual, had just come out. It was a specialized library for organic agriculture. And the founder of that library, Dr. Stuart Hill, he was on a track of permaculture before we heard about permaculture. So he was my professor in ecology. And the way he was talking, it was like, wow, this makes so much sense. He was talking about we need an agricultural redesign. That's what his point was. We need redesign how the system functions. And because he was very interested in organic, but saw the limitations of organic. And he said, we need to redesign. And I was hearing this in his courses and I thought, gee, that makes so much sense. And then not long after that, the book came out. And when I saw it, I spent 3 weeks, I ordered it right away. And I spent 3 weeks just devouring the book. And because to me, permaculture, I had studied as a biologist. I knew the whole ecology, the wildlife, the habitats. And I understood all that for my area anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I did a master's in landscape architecture. And so I understood design and how to do designs. And And then when I saw the book Permaculture, it's like finally somebody has put together all these notions into one. And to me, it was exactly the tool I needed. It was a way of bringing all this together into a logical system, a way to transfer it to other people and talk about it. Because it's like, yeah, before that, it was how do you kind of explain to people what you're interested in? I was interested in it. It was to me, even before I discovered it, I was thinking of ways to make areas more attractive to wildlife. That was my practice. I was designing habitats for people, for wildlife, to get more birds and get more animals. I was 20, 30 years before my time in that. And today it would be an easy go to do a practice set up in that. But anyway, so finding the book about permaculture, to me, that was it. And then I just needed to be able to practice this on a larger scale. And so we started looking. We looked for 2 years, found the farm, and it was like, this is gonna do, because I was ideally looking for an orchard, and this was the smallest orchard we could find, which was 12 acres or 5 hectares, with 4,000 trees. It was a tough slog. It was a big learning curve. I mean, I remember speaking to the real estate agent at the time and saying, "What's a rootstock?" I didn't even know what a rootstock was, and he had to explain to me. And it's like, okay, I'm starting from scratch.
Yeah, that's but didn't deter you. You did it anyway, which is great. So is your place where you live, or is it
No, I
is
live
it
about an hour away.
how does
I
that
live.
work? Because it's something I'm going through at the minute. It's basically it doesn't really make sense to buy a bigger property here, but at the same time, I don't want to move out of the city. How does that work for you?
It depends what you want. You have, like, I would say, I knew that I wanted a place that would be my lab, that it would be a place that I could experiment, that I could try things, and that I would not impact neighbors really. It was just, it's large. On two sides, I have grain crops, corn, soybean crops. On one side, I have the town's sports field. And on the other side, I have an active gravel pit. So it's just a hole that they've dug. That's what's surrounding me. So when I saw the place, it was like, this is perfect. And I had, because they were digging and they dug below the water table next door, I had in that contract of sale, there was perpetual right to all the water I need. And there was already a pipe from the farm going to the lake next door in the gravel pit. And I thought, wow, all the water I need on top of it. And it's surface water, not groundwater, because there's a big temperature difference. If we pump groundwater, and we have lots of groundwater, it's not far, it's 2.5 meters down. But if we pump that, it's at about 9 degrees all year round. And in the summer, giving trees 9 degree water is a bit of a chill. So the idea of surface water was much better. It'll get to 20 degrees, 25 degrees in the summer. And so anyway, those were all factors that made that it made sense. But it was far. So there was like, it's good, but it's far. We started looking close, but if you're looking for a place, you realize it doesn't take long that the area is close to a city. The prices are not agricultural land prices. I mean, this is so I quickly realized, oh, can't afford that, can't afford. And then we just basically in concentric rings from the city, we would look and know it's still expensive, still expensive. Finally found the place we could afford. And that was it. And in the end, you know, Cormac, it's been a blessing because I don't live there. And so I go, I do all the farm work I need to. I go, we stay there. We have a trailer and we just stay there and however long we want. But when I close the gate and I leave, I'm done. Like, and a lot of times for farming, and farming has a high suicide rate because you're never away think of any other businesses. Is there another business that you live in your business? You know, you'll go, you have a shop, you go, you have a factory, you go, you have whatever it is, you don't live in the business unless it's something like you have where it's in the home, it's from the home. Okay. But you have an office and you go to the office and you're doing your work and it's like you close the door and I'm done for the day. It you could think about it and so on, but it's you could, there's got to be a separation. For farming, you live on the property. Anywhere you look, you see, oh, I have to do this. Oh, this is, oh, I gotta fix that and this. And so you never mentally, you never have a real break. And some farmers have told me, you know what? On this day, I just, I'm off. That's it. I'm off. You need a day off once in a while or an afternoon off. You need some time just for your sanity, because especially in farming, and it's not like in the UK where I consider you don't even have a winter. Like you have access to the soil pretty well all year round. For us, we have between between 3 and 5 months with snow cover. So that's a complete, almost complete break for us. You can't do anything with the soil. We have pruning season. Okay. So we can go and prune, and it's therapeutic to go and prune because it's you've kind of been indoors for a while and it's good to go. But having that break is so important. Anybody who's growing or raising is different because you have to have eyes on the animal. If you're not paying attention to your animals, that's where always something happens. And we've had animals, we've had up to 100 sheep and not being there. And it works, but that's when things happen. That's when you have problems arise.
No, that's great stuff. I bring it up because I didn't sort of consider this until I was chatting with Brian Norton on the show that basically he has a property that he doesn't live at. And it just dawned on me then that it's a possibility. And then yourself, you can still do great things and whilst not living on it. And as you say, the mental health aspects is fantastic. So for me, I just switch the computer off. So once the computer's off, that's it, I'm done. And I'm very good at regulating that myself. It's that pressure of having to constantly look around and go, all these things need done. I think that's great. And it's a great example of you can do great stuff and not have to live on the land.
It helps to have perennials
Yeah.
as opposed to, and it's true. If you are growing vegetables, for example, they just need that much more attention, especially when you replant or you transplant. Oh, so one of the things that's helped us immensely, I can be here, and if we're in season, the irrigation system is on, everything's automated. So I program when I want watering to go on, and it just, whether I'm here or not, it goes on. And a pump, an electric pump, is super reliable. You know, I've changed one pump in 25 years.
Wow.
After 25 years, I changed the pump. So it's like, you know what? It just works. You don't have to think about it, and you can set it up. There are tools even that you say, oh, well, it rained today, so I don't need water. It will click off and shut the system off for a day or two, whatever. All those exist. You can automation in agriculture has come a long way. And in fact, when we bought the controllers, they're called controllers to control the irrigation, they were like $500. I can buy a better one than what we had back then for $120 today, as it's electronics. So electronic prices have really gone down and their performance has gone up. So all things automation can start being expensive, but with time, they really get cheaper. And I mean, if somebody has, you can get them now with that, you plug it in where your pipe comes out of the wall, put in a little battery powered controller and plug a hose to it. So if somebody says, well, I have just my yard, well, you could have your yard watering automatically while you're away doing consulting or you're off for a week vacation or whatever. Your yard will be watered. All your plants will be watered if needed, and you can have a shutoff switch if it rains. And so, I find watering, when I see people watering by hand, I kind of go, oh my God, they didn't get the memo.
Especially 4,000 trees. That may be a bit challenging. Luckily here in Ireland, we maybe get the odd once every 2 or 3 years we get a drought, a dry spell. We're lucky enough. But it is, when I'm designing, I always think, how much energy does the person have? And if they don't have much, perennials, stick in all perennials just, and then it's done once, and then they just have that more benefits.
And what people don't realize is perennials, the biggest work is the first 3 years. And it's pretty well just mulching and training the trees. That's the most effort because your trees are mostly not producing yet. So you don't even have any concern about the quality of the fruit or so on. But after 5 years, my goodness, like we calculated 2 years ago, we were spending a half day a week of maintenance for the whole farm. And most of that was from mowing and the vegetable garden, most of the maintenance. So your maintenance starts, it's quite a workload. And with time, it just, if you've done the job, and that there is some caveats, if you've trained your trees, and I really put a lot of emphasis training trees because pruning can be a big job. Like I blocks in the orchard that I haven't pruned in 2 years. This is going on 3 years, and I look and I go, eh, you know what? They could do another year. It's that much of a saving if you've got your trees set up right, which means the tree, the branches are really below horizontal. It makes all the difference in the world. Your trees just think all I have to focus on is producing fruit. And so because they're not producing excess of branches for nothing that you end up cutting off, your workload goes down. So much of pruning is just removing branches that are caused by improper pruning or improper branch training. They just didn't train their branches. And so it just buys them so much work. Like for you, I would put a rider, I don't know how you would call it, for a follow-up. You do a consulting, you do an installation, and you should have, here's year one, year two. I have to come in for half a day each and I'll train your trees. I'll set them up because that person, not knowing necessarily what's involved, you would be saving them for the life of those trees so much work. If their tree starts off and it's really set, now you go, all they're looking at is they flower beautifully, they produce fruit. It's like, you don't even have to prune it. I have a whole block of trees that I never pruned. I did some training. But I only prune because if a branch is really cutting up my access, my aisle, or, and so I'll cut that. But otherwise, they're not pruned. And I think, do we have? No, we don't have. If you set up the tree, you don't have to prune. So that whole thing of, oh, you got to prune every, no, you don't have to prune every year. Your tree knows what it's doing. It's not like a tree, fruit tree, automatically, if you grew it in the wild, it won't work because it's, no, it works. It sets itself up. It branches the way, and it works. It doesn't produce perhaps as colorful as fruit or as big a fruit, but it will produce. And it will do really well. But
Yeah.
setting them up early, that first 2 years, 3 years, I would say, try to get that. Try to make the client understand that that's an important part for the long term, because once the tree is set, it won't change. It's like there's a proverb that says, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he's old, he will not depart from it. And it applies exactly to a tree. You set up that tree in the way it'll go, which means the branching pattern, and even when the tree is old, it's set. It won't depart from that. It won't all of a sudden go, you know what, I think I need a new top. It won't. So it's pretty amazing. Trees will really respond to our care, and then for the life of that tree, it'll just be so fruitful.
My biggest challenge was not taking any fruit off it for the first couple of years. And I don't know if that was done, but I got fruit on the 3rd year and the tree nearly fell over. There was that much on it. So for me, that worked, but it was just that trying, if it broke my heart, picking that flowers off, they allow that the roots to develop.
I wouldn't necessarily pick off flowers, but yeah, you can certainly, when the tree is that small and it's just not structured, and that means you're trying to grow trees on a really dwarfing rootstock, which
Yeah.
the tree doesn't hold on its own. And that's another factor. I mean, if you do that, I would definitely grow them either on a trellis or on a stake and stake them for the life of the tree. But that's because those trees by nature are meant to be given a trellis. Like, orchards don't grow those ultra dwarfing trees without a support, because the trees, the root system is not that big. It's not really able to hold the tree up. So you get a nice tree if you support it.
Yeah, I did have one tree fall over.
I have two. I have several, and then, yeah, that's just their limitation if you don't stake them or support them.
loads of fruit off them. I probably should have thinned them out a wee bit as well. I'm not sure. Because this is the amount of fruit, they just the branches just they fall over and hit the ground.
Yeah, the branches, that's great. You do want the branches to go down. And if they do, that's perfect. It's just that often the higher branches being loaded will also bend the whole trunk. So it's kind of looking, your bottom branches, you want them to go down. As they get higher, you really do want to lighten the load if the trunk is just not big enough yet, and let it be able to support that. For us, it's when we get a big wind. Last year was a bad year for that because we had such a record crop and we had a strong wind. So the tops are loaded and they're kind of swaying in the wind and pow. So we had a lot of trees, especially in the Asian pears. All the Asian pears cracked at the top. They can't, I don't thin. So I really, it's one of the things we just, why thin? There is going to be creatures and there's going to be insects that will thin a little bit. So hopefully they do enough of a work, but when you have a record year, even they don't make that much of a difference. So in those years, well, we do have some damage. You got to realize that's the side effect.
Yeah, so I always tell clients as well that you're gonna have losses. You have to just share it. So they last that long in an orchard. You obviously must have had, as well as the sort of learning about the biology and getting the best growth, the business side of things. How did you learn that, and is that sustainable as well? For just for listeners, that basically how do you make something that got profitable if they were thinking about it now in order to keep it going?
Yeah, it absolutely, if it really is just a function of how much work I want to put into harvest. I don't want to put any work into harvest anymore. We do a membership you pick, so we'll send out our emails to, we have 2,000 people on a membership list, and we, based on what the harvest is, last year I just underestimated what the harvest would be, and so I think we were at 80 families. I should have been probably at 120 families last year. So we just didn't have enough people to harvest all of the fruit. And that's just adjusting based on trying to evaluate what the crop load will be and how many people. And by allowing members, what happens is that's how we balance basically supply and demand. I don't want people to come and go, oh, there's nothing left today. So that's what I try to avoid. I err on the side of I'd rather lose some fruit, but at least the last people who've come in that day, they still experience, oh wow, there's two trees. Look at these, they're loaded, and then they can pick. So that's just the way I do it. I mean, if I wanted to put more effort, I could definitely supply like we do a U pick, not a U pick, a honor system kiosk, a little roadside stand, and that's simple. We just pick, put them in baskets of different sizes, and people just buy. And that's a great honor because we're not there. We don't even matter. I could be home in the city and people are stopping. They're buying what they want. They just put the money in and they take. And we've found, oddly enough, people think, how can you do that? You know, people are going to steal your money. Well, there's a box. It's a steel box. Good luck trying to take the box. But what we found is that we tend to have more money than what's sold on average. It's because if people go and then, oh, this, we try to make it round off like $5, $10. We don't try not to have $7 or 7 pound baskets, because then they have to have change and they don't usually. If you just stop and you go, okay, I'll take that, it's a 10 or it's a 5 or it's 15 or it's 20. Those are nice units because people tend to, but even that, if it's 15 and I don't have a 15 and I have a 20, and so they'll look and maybe they'll take something else and it'll be 20. But if they don't want something else, they'll put 20 and they'll take a 15. So we see regularly we have about $5 difference from what was purchased and what amount of money. So, you know, I always go by the saying, if you sow, if you sow trust, you reap honesty. So we, by putting that there, we're not there. You just handle it yourself. We trust you. So we're sowing trust, and in return, we really get honesty. So it's a beautiful system. I mean, it would work, I think, even in a, you know, close to the city where you have a lot of people. I've heard other people have similar systems, and they say, yeah, it's a great system. All you're doing is, one guy has, I think he has 12 stands that he sets up in different areas, and he just goes along every day and collects his cash and replenishes the stand. So it works. You just have to trust that, you know, sometimes we've had, before we had a better box, we used to allow people to go and get change even. So in those days, we had a couple times where the locals who inhabited the pubs just needed something to make sure they could go to the pub. So they found out, and then they go, oh, I know where I can go get something to go to the pub. And so we stopped that, made it harder for them. And so now it's fine.
Yeah, I found it even in my front yard. I took down a 3 foot fence and put up fruit trees, raspberries, and people are going, they're going to steal them. They're going to steal them. And it's like, nobody steals your fruit. And my attitude as well, if they steal it, happy days. I've actually shared some fruit, really tasty fruit with somebody. So it's, I like your attitude. I like that sort of laid back attitude towards it. It's just, well, it's there, and your attitude to the work as well. Because in permaculture too, people can get very serious about things, and having to be there and having to do all this really fantastic work. But it's just like, right, just relax. You go to your farm, you do your work, you go to your orchard, you do your work, and then you come home and relax. I think that's
I
great.
saw that when I was doing landscape designs, and I realized you can do the best design and you go, man, this project, it rocks. I mean, it's going to be a great project. But if the maintenance side of it is a fail, it doesn't matter how well designed it is, your whole project can fall apart. And I really started to kind of hammer out the essentials to minimize maintenance, because everybody wanted low maintenance. No maintenance doesn't exist, but low maintenance, you can get there. And there are things you have to respect. And so I was really obsessive about how to set up this orchard. I don't want to spend my life maintaining the orchard. So it had to be dialed in. And I mean, I spent 30 years working on this. I really worked out a system where it's like, okay, you know what? Everything is done in the least maintenance way possible, because the only people who make money from maintenance are the ones who are paid to do maintenance. Because if you put in a project, your client doesn't benefit from having extra maintenance. Some people, and there is a small proportion of people who they just love the idea, I want to go in the garden and do something, and that's fine for a garden. But a farm is not a garden. And you realize, I don't want to go there. If I want to do something, there's always something I could do. But it's between you could do and these are things you have to do, there's a big gap there. So we put together a master class, and there's one course in their maintenance, and that one, it's important, because it will not make you any money to do maintenance. So make sure your system is thought through. And I use the Pareto principle, you know, 80-20 rule. 80% of your time is going to be spent on 20% of your area. And you can even dial that to 90% of your time is going to be on 10% of the area. There's some spot in your yard that is so high maintenance. And so I go, okay, that's the high maintenance. Let's change that. Let's do it differently. Get rid of that. And all of a sudden, oh, it's easier. Get rid of the next bottleneck like that. Oh, it's easy. And then you go, man, there's always going to be that 80-20. Like we know our parking is the part that takes the most maintenance. Just when we changed the design, you know, I made some changes, but it's still by the way it's shaped because it's kind of this triangles where cars park at 45 degree angle. It just the way it's set up, it's not as easy to mow. It takes more maintenance. And I'm okay with that because it's the entrance and it's a first impression. So it's good that it's not as wild or as not unkept, but it's not as untouched as other areas. But really understand that whatever you're doing, even if it's for a garden and especially for you as the designer, if you design an area for a client who likes low maintenance and you put in something high maintenance, like really shame on you because you haven't done your work. You're paid to do that. You're paid to think through these things. And there are strategies, there are techniques that will lower your maintenance. And so really get that because people will never complain that they don't have enough to maintain. It's nice. There's almost nothing to do in this garden. Fantastic. You know, you've done a great job. And even I think a lot of the permaculture designs, especially when they talk about like chop and drop, and chop and drop is fantastic on a smaller scale where you can go around with a knife and you know, cut. That's great. But when you get into hectares, it's not as romantic as it seems. I remember the first year I thought, you know what? I learned how to scythe. I can scythe. And I thought, yeah, you know what? I could probably maintain the aisles, the grassy aisles between the trees with the scythe. So I took a scythe and I went out. And our rows, our shortest rows are 100 meters and our longest ones are 150 meters. And I went out and it was a real good workout. I'd do 100 meters in about an hour and a half. And I thought, okay, that's one aisle. I have 72 aisles, most of them 150 meters. And I thought, just doing the math, I said, that's 72 hours of good workout. Like it's a workout. I don't know if you've ever saw it, but it's a workout. And I realized, okay, that's romantic. That's nice. But that's not practical. All I'll do is I'll be spending the whole season just going along and scything. So obviously that doesn't work. And so think of the work you have to do. Think of one, how to just eliminate it. You don't have to do it. And often it's one plant or it's one where you put it. It's just a high maintenance situation. Getting rid of that. It doesn't mean you don't grow that, but don't grow it there. Grow it somewhere else, maybe in your zone four. You know, that's fine. Area that you don't go as often, it's all right. And so eliminating maintenance, you'll never regret it. I mean, you don't make money on maintenance.
No, and it's a being busy fallacy as well. Just because you're doing stuff doesn't mean you're being productive when you're busy. You mentioned there in the masterclass, what I like about you, yourself and your content as well is you figure all this out, but you share it and you share it free on your YouTube channel and you also have a class. Do you want to tell us how that came about and the education side of things?
I kind of started when I was in grad school. I did a master's in biology as well in animal behavior. And I started giving presentations because we had to do graduate studios or graduate seminars. And so we would present and I thought, you know what? I like this. I like the idea of presenting and getting feedback and so on. And it started from then, and it wasn't long. I was doing a teaching assistant for one of my professors, and there too, I was teaching, and it went on. And after I'd finished my landscape architecture, I realized, okay, you know what? I've got enough background. I can start presenting. And somebody asked me, would you present? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And so I began. And so it's been over 30 years. I've been working as a professional speaker where I would go and give presentations. And so that was, it was just realizing what I enjoy. I love the idea of seeing people's eyes kind of light up, like, I never thought of that, or, oh, that makes so much sense. That's such a better way of doing it. And so I did that, and then that led to teaching. So I taught for elementary groups. I taught in junior college, and I taught for 8 years at university. So that was kind of, okay, I've done that. And I realized one thing is it's just as much effort to prepare and give your material to a class of 15, like I had sometimes 15 students. It's just as much work for that as if I was speaking to a group of 500 or. And then when I realized online, to me, I loved speaking to a group. And then I realized I really love having a camera. Because now I'm speaking to one person, which can translate to millions of people in the case of a video. If a video goes viral and millions, we have one that has 4 million views. I've actually had a chance to impact 4 million people for the same preparation. So I always like to work smarter, not harder. And I realized, wow, online, I can reach so many more people than I could with an audience. I mean, there's no way I could fit in a place where there's 4 million people. So that just, it made me realize there's so much more potential with putting content online, and YouTube was a great start for that. And then after that, people were always asking me, could you help me with this? Could you help? And then we realized, okay, actually before that we did this film, The Permaculture Orchard Beyond Organic. So that was, it was meant to be a kind of a documentary film. It was 2 hours, but it really is a mini class on setting up a permaculture orchard, but it's very dense. Like there's a lot of material in there. And so I did that. And that's where I really realized, okay, online in front of a camera, I'm going to switch. I still do some presentations, but not nearly as many as I used to do. And the focus is put it online, get it out there, and help as many people as possible.
Yeah, well, you've definitely influenced myself. In my garden, I have two tree trios, one pear and one apple. And then in my designs, I always put the three trios in and always reference you as well. So that does spread out as well. I think your work, I think it's great. And for me, just putting all that stuff together and making the best use of your rows and things like that is a really good place to start for people. And you teach a masterclass, did you say? Is that available online?
Yes,
for people to purchase.
Yep, it's permaculture.study. So it's our basically my life's work I put into that. There's over 26 hours of video, and it goes from an introduction to permaculture all the way to marketing and selling what you've grown. But in there, there's some real gems. There's one whole course just on observation, because permaculture is based on observation. As a biologist, I really learned how to observe. As a landscape architect, I had to really be focused. And I realized it's a skill. You don't realize you're learning it, but it's a skill. And how do you learn to observe? How can you walk a site and go, oh, you know what? This is a wet spot here. And people go, how do you know that? Well, look, everything's telling me that this is a wet spot. And so it that sense of observation is important. You can develop it. You can cultivate it. So I give you it's a whole framework and a course to understand how. Another one is the magic model. And that one I really love, because working with clients, presenting plans. I came upon one couple that when I was presenting the plan, I'd ask, and the husband was an architect. I knew he understood plan, but I'd look at his wife and she had a puzzled look. And I said, do you get this? She says, no, to me, it's just circles and things. I don't understand that at all. And I realized, oh, wow. I had not ever thought that not everybody could look at a plan and walk through the project. I thought, well, yeah, but it's not an obvious thing to see a plan and project it into three dimensions and be able in your mind to walk through and basically interpret the drawing into a three dimension. And so I thought, okay, not everybody gets it. And so I said, okay, give me a week. I'll come back and we'll. And so that was kind of the basis of the magic model. It's a way of playing with design, getting people involved in a design that I've never designed. And this is where I say I democratize design, because it's not just for designers. Anybody can design. If you've ever gone on vacation, you can design. Because it's the same framework. You're doing the same things. Where am I going? How much do I have to go on this vacation? And, you know, so it's just a few simple steps to planning, but in a way that makes it like a game. And because it's three-dimensional, I mean, I've taught this on three continents how to design with the magic model. So that's a course right there. And that's helped a lot of people who, you know, I don't, and you teaching PDCs, you've seen that, you know, it's like, I don't feel like I'm graphically competent. I do the magic model is meant to be a 7-year-old feels very comfortable doing it. So everybody's pretty well gone through that stage. And it's meant to be, it's also a way I found when people are drawing, they're creative, but you have to tap into that childlike state of just having fun. That's when you're really at your most creative. I was teaching landscape plants and design in university, and there too, I realized, you know what? I'd have them submit a plan because just the requirements of it, but I'd have them design using the magic model. And it's so easy to take a magic model after and make a plan out of it, because you've got something that you feel very free. For example, you go see a client, here's your design. And now they go, well, what about if this is here? Not as easy on a plan, especially if you've rendered it, especially if you've, you know, colored it up or whatever. Oh gosh, that's a lot of work to change. Magic model, simply, well, that those trees here, pop them out, put them over here. There you go. And now we can walk around the site just looking at your model. And it's meant to be so simple that a 7-year-old can do it. So it's, I mean, that's just kind of it's culmination of a lot of things. Like I said, maintenance course, site selection. Wow. Site selection in itself, if somebody hasn't got a project site and they're going to buy a site to grow, like that's where I've saved people sometimes $100,000, because they don't know how to select a good site. And if you make that mistake and you pour in thousands of pounds to do the project, and then you realize this wasn't the right site. I mean, that happens. And so you look at orchards, for example, often it's second, third generation, maybe more, that people have done orchard. They know what's involved for a good site. They can select the site. But you go, oh, I'm interested in putting in a permaculture orchard. And do you know what makes a good site? Can you spot a site and go, that would be a great place for an orchard? So there's, I forget some, but there's a whole lot of parts, nature's allies. That comes from my biology training, really getting nature to work for you. Because if you don't get that, you don't have an ecosystem. You have a bunch of trees. It's not working. That's where I did everything I could in our organic orchard, which was still a monoculture. And because we didn't have the design of Trios using that diversity as a framework for the whole orchard, it was always going to give me problems. No matter what I put or what I spray or whatever, the design of it is broken. So designing, and that's the importance of using Trios, you start off right away with the diversity in the very fabric of the trees.
Yeah,
Yeah,
definitely.
there's so
Site selection here for me as well, because where my house is, I'm on a north-facing hill, so the sun disappears in I don't know, November, December, and doesn't come back to March, just because
Oh.
it just doesn't come above the hill. So we get more frosts here, so it could be sunny some place in town, and we're still frozen. The front street just doesn't, even the south-facing just doesn't get any sun.
Yeah,
So that.
I actually discussed that in the course, because you do wanna have an idea. Are you it can be depressing. I know there's valleys where, like you say, for months there's no direct sun. It's light, but there's no sun. I
Yeah.
think don't buy there.
And I lived in South Wales as well, and it's all valleys. So it is depressing at times, that winter period, because you see very little sun, because you're faced with these big mountains either side of you, and it's very claustrophobic. And what do you call it? Sad, the seasonal affective
Yeah.
disorder is quite prevalent there. So these things matter to humans, and how we move day to day. So if so where do I find the master class? Is that on your website?
Yeah, at permaculture.study. We made it as simple as possible. Just go there. You can start any of the courses for free. There's two videos of every course released for free, so just see that. On the YouTube, we just released over the winter one video from each course, and just check it out. I mean, it's if I can't help you, no problem. I understand that teachers, you either resonate with a teacher or not, and so I know I'm not for everyone. And but if you find, hey, you know what, I want to do this, and you say, oh, I like these videos, they're good, then consider it. You know, you can start with just one course, or you can go with the whole master class. It's pricier than other courses, but I know that if you don't want that, just check out, I mean, YouTube. There's all kinds of videos. We don't have everything that's in the master class, but we have a lot of things in there, just not as structured, let's say, as the master class would be. You do have to look around and find, but I'm a teacher at heart. I recognize that it's very easy to present things in a way that's complicated. It's very easy to try to confuse people because it's like, oh, I don't understand this. It's very hard to understand things at a point where you can make them simple. And that's really my goal for all of this, is if I don't understand it, I'm not talking about it. But there's so many things that I get it. Like, I've done this. I spent my 20s in university. I've done my homework. And so now I realize, okay, I can help people in a way that's understandable, that's simple, because if you find something confusing, you'll tend not to want to continue. And so it's there. To me, it's like that's my, like I say, my life's work is compiled in that master class. Anything that somebody's considering putting in, I would say over 30 to 50 trees, you're starting to have an orchard. If you're putting in two trios, you don't need them. You can get everything you need from the videos. But as you get into an orchard scale, there are things that, I mean, I've gone from, you know, I've had 4,000 trees. I know what's involved in taking care of an orchard, but also in a way that you can be super over-equipped. I didn't have the means, so I had to figure out ways to get the work done without being equipped with the best things. And so that's a consideration, because it's easy to just say, oh, I'll just buy a tractor and I'll buy a sprayer and I'll, yeah.
Yep, avoid the type one errors. Just
Oh,
pay it up
yeah.
front. So we have a course as well. I don't know if you looked at it. We're calling it PDC to professional. So it basically takes you from a PDC graduate. What do you do when you graduate? So how do you get your, if you're sketching your drawings, basically we teach you how to get going on digital design. So you can draw on Affinity. I think Affinity is about $70 at the minute, and that's one-off payment. How you get your base map on there, your scaling right, and then how do you start actually putting on your layers, adding in your tree trios, adding in your market gardens and all your things, and how you get started, how do you build a website, basically then how do you build your portfolio, do a couple of designs on Affinity, get them then on a website so you can start showcasing your work, and then how do you go about then? It's basically setting up a consultancy, and it just gets you introduced to that. So for the listeners there as well, check out Stefan's course if you're interested in ours too. Stefan, I want to pick your brain if that's right. So I'm
Hopefully.
moving house, and my estate agent has told me to get rid of my fruit trees in the front garden. I know they're the devil.
Who asked you to get rid of them?
The estate agent, so I have to go back to the lawn, but I want to take the trees with me anyway.
Okay.
So they're starting to bud. What would be the best method at this stage? They take the tree as a whole, or start taking
How old
cuttings?
are they?
They're about 7 or 8 years old. They're dwarf variety.
That's getting a little long, but the only way that will increase their chance of actually transplanting is I would root prune them. When do you have to get them out?
Next couple of weeks.
Oh, okay. There's usually you're looking for a 1 year frame in that way where you cut the roots, let them regrow in the zone that you've cut. And then you can dig them after a year. So you're
Right.
concentrating the roots there. In your case, it's simply try to dig out the most of the roots. So start quite far. And if you see, oh, there's still pencil-sized roots there, well, you can't really go much bigger than that sometimes. So just try and dig up, and you'll end up with a few larger branches. Don't cut the branches when you dig it up, unless they're broken, but don't cut the branches, the roots, or the branches. So when you transplant, what will happen is you will have certain branches die. And that's normal, but don't, like some people say, oh, because I dug them up and there's books with this and it's been shown to be a total fallacy. Oh, you should cut back everything. Don't do that because each branch is connected to a root. It's not this root supplies the tree. No, this root supplies this. It's like a straw going from above, going down along the trunk and going into the ground as one root. So you don't know what root has been cut the most. And that's where the one that's been cut or broken off, that branch will dry up. It has no more root and it will dry up. But don't cut back. Just put it in, mulch it when you transplant it, mulch it well. Because it will have the most chance of having water stress this year. And I mean, it will probably be a year and a half that it won't do anything. It may flower this year because the fruit buds have been set. I would take all the flowers off. It's a bit of a job, but because you want it to concentrate on vegetative, because what a tree will do when it senses that it's so stressed, it'll do a last-ditch effort to put out as many flowers as possible to produce as many fruit and therefore as many seeds as possible because it senses it's dying. I've seen it dozens of times where you'll be picking and you go, my goodness, this tree is absolutely loaded. Like it's crazy the amount of fruit. That winter, that tree's dead every time. So for you don't want the tree to focus on producing fruit because that's basically its way of emptying its roots because it senses it'll be too stressed. So if you take off the fruit, the flowers, the tree goes, I have no stressor in producing fruit, so I'll just regrow and it will start regrowing. But it will probably take it a couple of years to
That's,
couple of years to
I
get
think
that.
you just saved a couple of trees for me.
I find it very strange that they require you to, I mean,
They
I
don't
think we
require,
should.
they advised it basically to go
Oh,
back to
okay.
just pure lawn, because I have raspberries, blueberries, I think I have two apple trees, two pear trees, a plum tree, It's basically a food forest in my front yard, and they said to get more money, I'm best taking it out. So I was trying to take it out and save the stuff. I want to take it with me anyway, so I can take the cuttings. So it's just them, they like a blank slate. Unless there's a permaculture person wanting to buy a house. It's just if they advised it, I could leave it there, but I want to take the stuff anyway.
I would actually personally, I would leave it there, even though they advise and they know clientele. But there's been such a move and such a revival of interest. I know from dealing with a lot of nurseries, that especially during COVID, up to now, they've not been able to supply the demand. There is a huge demand. And if people looking to buy a place go, look at that, there's already a food forest, it's already producing. Because their desire is to buy a place and maybe be able to put in a food forest. And if they see it, it won't be for everyone, but those, especially younger people, they'll look at that. And if they have children, they go, man, the kids will be able to eat this year. So personally, I would take cuttings, but I would leave the trees. You can always buy rootstock and graft and start over because honestly, your tree will be in 2 years, your tree will be in better shape than your 7-year-old tree transplanted. Because that first 2 years, it will just grow, it will do really well. The transplanted tree, 7 years is brutal. That's a that's a that tree, those roots are, you don't realize, but they don't go to the crown. That was kind of the drawings as, you know, the roots will grow to the crown. No, that's baloney. They go way beyond it. I find they generally will grow to the height of the tree. That's what I find. Like that drawing should be whatever the height, the roots are that far. So if you have 2 meters, your roots are 2 meters out. They're not to the drip line.
Yeah, that's probably right. I might just leave them then and just tell them. Stephen, that's been great. Thank you very much. That's been the Permaculture Vine podcast, and that's been Stephen Sokowiak. Anything else you'd like to finish with, or?
Just start.
Yes, great advice.